We're fortunate this morning that not only do we have one distinguished guest, but two. Mr. Long and others around this table will testify that the bombshell that hit the University of Virginia was not any cut in the budget from Richmond, not any decline in physical facilities, but was the retirement last year of Professor Innes Claude. Since then, things have been going steadily down. But to try to get them reversed, why we have prevailed upon him to chair this meeting, and this is especially a happy event because of the close friendship between our speaker and Professor Claude.
Thank you, Ken. Even though that was a partially exaggerated statement. Part of it was. But not about the friendship. That's all right.
That's all right.
Our speaker today is Dr. Jacob J.G. I think that stands for Jacob J.G.
Jacob is the right.
Seattle. Better known as Yope. I never heard him called Jacob. He was educated first in his native Indonesia, Bandung, and then pursued his higher degrees at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands, London School of Economics, and last but not least, a lowly American university known as Yale.
He's from Harvard.
We have a certain right. He has the doctorate in law from Yale. Dr. Seattle has spent virtually all of his academic career, professional career, at the Institute of Social Studies in The Hague, in the Netherlands. He's been a resident of the Netherlands most of his adult life. That institute is an inter-university establishment created by the Dutch government and the Dutch universities, and it is their contribution to the promotion of the development of the Third World. It was founded in 1952 or so and has served as a training ground for young professionals, graduate students, government officials from virtually every country in the non-European world. The Institute brought us together. We were new boys there at the same time in 1964. I came over as a Fulbright scholar. And Yope had recently finished his doctorate and was beginning a career on the staff of the Institute. And we collaborated as the founding fathers of the program for young diplomats in international relations, a year's course at The Hague. And that was the beginning of a happy friendship. Yope survived the collaboration with me during that year. He survived the enthusiastic and affectionate attachment of my three children. That was sometimes more difficult than anything else, I think. And went on to a very fine career at the Institute of Social Studies. At other times, he has lectured and been visiting professor at a number of places. He has taught at Leiden, University of Leiden in the Netherlands, in Nigeria, and Manila, and Jakarta, in Ann Arbor, Michigan, other underdeveloped areas like those. And has been a visiting lecturer and presenter of papers at conferences, etc., throughout Asia, Africa, Europe, a bit in Latin America, I believe, and most recently in Australia. He has, in recent years in particular, that narrows it a bit, been a very close observer of the development and activities, the internal workings of the non-aligned movement, the organized Third World group that meets periodically in summit conferences and in other kinds of meetings. Yope has attended most of the major conferences of the non-aligned movement over a number of years and has made himself an expert on the internal politics of the non-aligned movement and its relationships with the rest of the world, including particularly the West, and even more particularly the United States. And he's going to talk with us today, focusing primarily on the relationship of the non-aligned movement, that formal expression of the Third World, with the United States, its reaction to American policy, American policy's reaction to it, and the interchange between the First World and the Third World in this regard. So it's with very great pleasure that I introduce my good friend, esteemed colleague, Joop Seetouw.
Thank you very much. This is a nice introduction. Thank you, Professor Thompson, for inviting me here, and thank you for coming here. It's always been a pleasure for me to come back to the United States, because if you have spent here so many years, some nice years, and have so many friends, I think it is easy to be willing to come back. And certainly I jumped at the occasion to come here. Having been here is also for me, and one of the reasons, knowing Americans and having so many good friends here, to be rather cautious in issues like the non-aligned movement, where our interests and certainly our words quite often clash. I think in my experience and my knowing Americans, and I know Americans are from many feathers, makes me cautious to just pass judgment on American policies. Although I often and sometimes severely disagree with the policies. But then I think the reverse might be also the case. And therefore the topic that I chose, or that I'm asked to talk about today, the relations between the non-aligned movement, another word in fact for the Third World and the United States, is a topic that indeed brings us to many confrontations and clashes between the United States and the Third World, which in my opinion is somehow rather regrettable and also at times difficult to understand. Regrettable, it seems to me, because your historical background, your mentality as a people, your long-term interest seems to point out in the direction of being able to develop easier relations with these former colonial peoples. And I think it's difficult to understand, because having been here, I think I have realized there is no country in the world where there's so much expertise, so much experience in such field as foreign policy, international relations, diplomacy. Then the question is, why is it that with all this expertise, American policies as seen from abroad, certainly at big international gatherings, so often lead to clashes and severe criticism? Is there no filtering through from, for instance, the academic world in America to those policymakers at the highest levels in Washington? I know that is something for you to answer. But I have always been surprised about that, because nowhere in the world, and I have traveled quite a bit, certainly also in Europe, are there people who can rival you in exactly expertise in those fields. And of course, if you talk about rivalry and about criticism that is launched towards the United States, and of course, including, almost by definition, to your presidents as the executive heads of this administration. Now that, of course, fortunately, has not always been the case, but it's also a remarkable thing, an interesting thing perhaps, to talk about that. And that is that it seems to me, and maybe my neighbor can later on support or deny what I said, it seems to me that before the Second World War, the generation just before me, the generation of Asian leaders that fought for the independence of their countries, they were very much aware of the United States, very much aware of your colonial history and your revolution. And they looked to America and to the American presidents, names like Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Lincoln, were very well known to them. Perhaps because they studied that quite often in jail when they were allowed to read quite a bit. And I sometimes think that some of our leaders now should have some time in jail to read about all these things. But they had the time and they understood and looked up towards the United States, I think. Now that changed completely. Because independence brought a young generation that was no longer so interested in the history of the glorious revolution, American Revolution, or in the ideas of democracy, liberty, civil rights, which was exemplified in your first presidents. If we were interested, now I belong to the generation, we are impressed and interested and taken by the power of America, by this big former colonial country that was able in such a short time to become a superpower. Not that we wanted to do it, but there was, we thought, perhaps a model, always the idea that you can emulate a certain model. And I think as of that time, you always will find that the inspiration of the United States as the formal colonial and the moral power had left. Now, I think that, I talked to Ines about it, I think that Mr. Leweber, who wrote his books about irreversible revolution and about the United States and Central America, where he said somehow and somewhere that America lost in the 19th century that aura of the champion of the oppressed people. That might be true for Latin America. Latin America has always been a very special part of the Third World. We have in the Third World problems with Latin America, as they have with us probably, but not so in Asia. I think up till the Second World War, there has been great admiration for America and American history. So I think after that, you see these differences. Perhaps you remember, especially in this area, that people like President Sukarno, who in his writings and in his biography, quite often refer to people like Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln, and others. And when he visited I think the United States in the 50s or the beginning of the 60s, he was keen, well, he was also a little bit showman, keen to show that he knew about the thoughts and ideas of these people. And therefore, I think we have now a different generation, and a generation that is perhaps, for better or worse, impressed by things like power and influence. And if they have taken one thing, that's perhaps also the interesting to mention. If they had in the past looked at these presidents in the United States as models, they don't do it now, but they are still very much impressed by the presidency as a function. As you well know, it's quite often copied and are part of the world. And that's quite understandable. If people come to power along revolutionary lines and have felt and exercised those big powers that leadership has given, they quite often tend to sympathize with the function of executive president, with big executive powers. The unfortunate thing is that quite often, knowing the American model, they forget to emulate also the other side, the Congress, to give something like a model of people's representation that could play a role as against the president. That is quite often forgotten. And our people, as we are, probably are too docile in the beginning to have put too much interest in that. Although I think the leaders are very much aware of the need for such kind of a balance, a check and balances. Even recently, last week, it was interesting, I thought about it when I saw it, President Mugabe of Zimbabwe, one of the smartest men, I think, in the Third World among the leaders, although he professed to be a Marxist, in his actions and in his measures, he showed himself very much a man who can play with all sides, if that is necessary, especially in his country. Now, he was talking about South Africa, about which perhaps later on I could just touch a little bit, and he said he was going to England to talk to Mrs. Thatcher, who, as you well know, is one of the few people, the only probably, who thinks that the attitude towards South Africa should be still be against sanctions, although even in the United States, the things have changed. And he said, I'm going to talk to Mrs. Thatcher about that. And the man asked him, what about Mr. Bush? Mr. Bush has already gone on record that he will not change the line drawn by Mr. Reagan? And then he said, yes, but then there's the Congress. So they are aware of that. That somehow in that political game, you have to look at two aspects of an administration. So I think it's interesting to show to you, I think, especially that in our part of the world, we are very much aware of the existence and of the powers of the United States. After this brief introduction, I think, I would perhaps say something about the relationship between now between the United States and the Third World. Perhaps the best thing to say now is that to talk a little bit about the terms that are quite often used interchangeably with regard to the Third World, although I will not go too deeply into that because that takes a lot of time, and I think you are aware of that. You know, of course, that the three terms are the Third World, the non-aligned movement, and the Group of 27. The Third World, of course, is that great number of states that came up after the war, mainly African Asian, but later on they include Latin America, although Latin America is quite older, mainly poor and developing countries, but then later on other countries joined the group, especially countries even in Europe like Yugoslavia, Malta, and Cyprus. Now, in this group came the idea that development, which they pursued as the main aim, could not be achieved if they would join into this big battle called the Cold War. And I think that has been, from that moment after the end of the Second World War, the main aim and objective of all three groups. You'll find it back in all their activities and all their documents, that they wanted to stay out of the Cold War, the dissociation from the Cold War. That is, in fact, one of the definitions given to the non-aligned movement, dissociation from the Cold War. In that effort, I think, they came up with negative as well as positive aspects. I just mentioned the negative aspect, dissociation from the Cold War. At the same time, it was linked to something that is very much to the heart of the Third World, three anti-movements, as always mentioned together, anti-colonialism, anti-imperialism, and anti-racism. And it's so trite to hear that all the time in books that one tend to say, well, there again. We are skip that. That is just rhetoric. It is rhetoric, of course, but not completely. I think if a person like me who has been away for so long from my country, and I meet other people from my part of the world, when we talk about issues like South Africa, it's more than only rhetoric. It's something that goes deep down, exactly because you have come this far. Exactly because I have been under the colonial system. And I look back and I look at my parents and my family, and I see how much talent, how much human talent has been spilled. They never came to fruition. Now, if you have that feeling, it stays with you. And colonialism is not just that coming of a certain group of people staying and ruling over you and going away and you're independent. It's that feeling that for generations, for centuries, people have just been spilled. Now, that is something that moves and makes you emotional about the situation. And therefore, perhaps that should be understood. And I think many policymakers in the West, including probably in the United States, have to write about it. They just skip this anti-colonialism, it's just words. It's not. It's something that at one time, I think, has best been expressed by Ben Bella, this African, this Algerian leader, who said, in the liberation of oppressed African people, we all should die a little bit, if that could be achieved. Then again, it looks like rhetoric, but it goes deeper. But I think, having said that, it's enough to talk about that, because it is only one of the aspects. There are, of course, also positive things, positive expressions of what the Third World and non-aligned movement want. First of all, they want what they call, again, rather stereotype, a democratization of international relations. meaning that they won't be in the important decisions made in the world, including the United Nations and specialized agencies. They want to participate in that because they say we are part of that world and we have been too long excluded from that world. We want to be in part of that. And as you well know, one of the aspects, of course, of this present world is the great stress on economic development. While we have for so long been criticizing, also in our part of the world, the overstress on the economic aspects of life, and now say that development, of course, is more than just economic well-being or material well-being. It's more than that. But still, it always comes back to the point that before you can start thinking about other things, you must have a certain level of well-being, material well-being. So therefore, this particular desire to change the terrible economic conditions of the third world. Those things perhaps are the general characteristics of the third world and non-aligned movement. And the non-aligned movement, of course, is a particular part. It's only two-thirds of the third world, because about 30 states in this third world are not member of that organized group of third world states called non-aligned movement. That's the difference. I should have told you that before. The third world is a loose group of 150 states that somehow identify with the poor developing world without being formally organized. Whereas the non-aligned movement is an organized group of two-thirds of that 150, about 100, who have specific goals, although they are not clearly described, have specific goals, and move in an organized way. Now, it is easier, therefore, I would say, to write and talk about the third world in the non-aligned movement form, because they express themselves officially and they can be observed. Remarkably enough, books abound on the third world. That is a popular topic. I always tell my students, if you want to be popular quickly, and especially more importantly, make a lot of money quickly, write a book on the third world. Everybody's waiting for it. But if you write about non-aligned movement, apparently, that does not sell. Probably because non-aligned movement is not so popular in that part of the world which is prosperous and can buy you books. This is the Western world. Now, there are three books, perhaps, if you ever would like to look into, and I will tell you a little bit about that, because it shows the problem about writing about non-aligned movement. And I go a little bit into that, because exactly that's the topic what I would like today, to show you the friction and criticism, mutual criticism, of the non-aligned movement and the American people or nation, which will carry on also in this new administration of President Bush. There's this old book from Peter Lyon, a friend of Innes and me, an Englishman, very clever, very bright, but the book is rather old. It is about the theory and or even the ideology of what is still called at the time neutralism. But neutralism, being rather negative in its expression, has been dropped by the third world itself, by the non-aligned movement, for the term non-aligned. And I will not go into that, but at least you should know that. Then there's the other book coming out in 1983. And it's interesting because it's written by an American, Richard Jackson, diplomat, who got time off, which it's so nice about this country. You can give you people time off to write good books, I think. And he wrote this excellent book about the non-aligned movement, the UN, and superpowers. But even better, I think, is the foreword by Ambassador Newsom. I'm not sure where is he.
Georgetown University.
Georgetown University. And he has one of the things that is, I think, is so dear to me in Americans. You can write about yourself, criticize yourself in such a nice way, as if it's just a nice talk that you have, which goes so very, very deep. You touch everything which is weak in your approach. And I think for a country to do that, you take away all the sting of my criticism. Because you yourself can do that. And I think he did it very nicely. So very, very well. In fact, I think that part for me personally was better almost than Jackson. Because Jackson is so very good in being able to compile all the important facts and give the interpretation. But it's like, I would say, like some of the best papers of our best students. You say it's excellent, but you feel almost any point you could see another nuance, and you would love to talk to him about that. Have you seen that? Because that's also possible. You have a very plausible and acceptable interpretation. But have you seen the other one? Because we happen to have that other. But the book as such, I think, is very, very good. And then there's the third book that is by Professor Singham, S-I-N-G-H-A-M, and Professor Hune, Shirley Hune, from New York University. Or is it Boston? No? Brooklyn University. Is that the, is it called Brooklyn University?
Brooklyn College, I think.
Brooklyn College. And he is originally, he was in, I think, Sri Lankan. He's now a professor here. And he has been following the non-aligned movement for about 15 years. He has been in there, he has been advisor, so he knows all about it. But he leans, that's the problem with the book, a little bit towards the other extreme. He is too sympathetic to what the third. He understands and therefore forgives probably too much about the third one. But if you take both, it's perhaps a good balance. I would like to talk a little bit now about the confrontation, because that is for us today perhaps the most interesting thing. Why this confrontation between the United States and the non-aligned world? The confrontation centers around perhaps three aspects of the non-aligned concept. This concept that they want to be dissociated from the Cold War, nothing to do with the big battle between the superpowers, and at the same time want to be in when big decisions are being made. Now, perhaps three words should be mentioned here: the immorality, the impossibility, and the impartiality in non-aligned thinking. Unfortunately, immorality has been given a very great place in non-aligned writing. And unfortunately, too, is that John Foster Dulles, and he must have been doing quite a lot as a Secretary of State, he is always remembered in the non-aligned movement for that unfortunate statement that he made about the non-aligned concept being in fact equal to immorality. It was immoral. In the big battle between evil and good, in other words, between the Soviet Union and America, you could not be neutral. How can you be neutral in such matters of life and death, and the value of a human being is that he chooses in such great big choices. Now the trouble is, I think it's very unfortunate, that was the time when both worlds, that is to say the non-aligned world, the developing world, and America, or the West, were rather excessively concerned with moral issues. I think it's understandable that after the Second World War, the West, having had that experience of the Second World War, and Nazism and fascism, that moral issues were number one in their thinking. But at the same time, the developing world, having fought this colonial struggle against something which they considered completely immoral, the subjugation of one people by the other, also kept thinking in sharp and harsh moral terms. And I think these two clashed, and it had something which the colonial countries, independent now, could not accept to be accused by Mr. Dulles for being immoral and not being able to choose. I've been looking back at some of my writing at that particular time and of my colleagues, and I think we all have, including me, been rather too sensitive about at that time. But then it has already been written, and I'm still alive, but Mr. Dulles cannot come up for himself, and he's still remembered all the time for that immorality statement. Now the other thing is, of course, is it possible to be neutral in this world? Is it possible to pursue a policy that keeps equal distance from the United States and from the USSR? And President Tito of Yugoslavia, one of the founders of the non-aligned movement, was the one who said, yes, this is possible. The so-called equidistance policy. You keep equal distance from the two, because that is non-alignment. Now, we all know, he probably also, that it is not possible in practice. because geographically, geopolitically, historically, economically, all developing countries have some ties this way or that way. But I think still it can be said that while some are leaning over leftwards very much and others rightwards, the majority is taking the middle field, the middle part. That can still be observed, I think. And therefore, in general terms, probably equidistance is perhaps too strict a term, but having a big pass in the middle is probably still possible. And then the other thing, which is perhaps the most important thing for our talks today, and maybe you would later on say something about that, is it possible to be impartial? Because that is the element that, according to my reading, has rankled the American people very much, and certainly the press and the media, that these non-aligned countries seem in their activities, and certainly their pronunciation, to be so very much anti-American. Why are they not very much anti-United States, the Soviet Union too, if you ask in the middle? Certainly, you should look both ways. Now, there are reasons for that. First of all, I think people forget that in terms of the struggle for independence, many developing countries have been given great moral and even material support by the Soviet Union. Many of our young leaders running away from jail and trying to escape the colonial government have found refuge in some of the socialist countries. And therefore it's understandable that this has not been forgotten. On the other hand, I think that idea that non-aligned movement is very much anti-American is, I think, misplaced. Probably here's the responsibility of the press that's not always well carried out. I was at a conference, the last one, the 8th summit in Harare in Zimbabwe. And as a freelance reporter, I don't have that ability that the dynamic, experienced journalists have. They come in, they listen, say, this, and then good, I come back later. And I talk, I ask your friends, and you make a few notes, and you have your article. For me, of course, I can't do that. I have to sit there day and night, as it were, and make my articles and try to make an article of that. But I have not heard anti-Americanism in such abundance as the newspapers make out. I think partly also it is sensitivities of journalists who don't take the time to go into the merits of a statement. You know, you read in the newspapers, and I've seen all over. I think it started perhaps in one of the major newspapers here, and it's taken over in Europe. It says that the final declaration mentioned 54 anti-American statements. Now, it means nothing to me until people tell me the statement was like this, and the background and the contents was like, 54 means nothing, as compared to 30 in the preceding summit in India. I've heard myself that Afghanistan was at the same time criticized as Nicaragua. There was no difference. Of course, in other issues, because the perception of the countries were that America was at fault or could have done more, they were being mentioned. Sometimes the issue was mentioned without the United States being mentioned. And surely you have to take into account, if you are a diplomat, that those things written down on paper are not always those things which are being said when the delegations are negotiating or talking. Anyway, it's more complex than only mentioning 54 times being anti-American. Because surely I know my people, Indonesian. They are not anti-American, although they're quite often very much annoyed by things that happen or being said. Why should Indonesia, which has been helped so much in its independence struggle, far more in the beginning by the Soviet Union, certainly our case was brought to the United Nations also by Belarus at one time, whereas the United States, understandably, had great commitments to its allies like Holland or Britain, who now claim their colonies back, and it's quite understandable that they also have to take that into account. But it means, in actual fact, that we got a lot of support, diplomatically certainly, but also materially, from Soviet Union. But there is no movement, and never had a mass movement, for driving Indonesia in the direction of socialism. It never was there. It had no chance. And that was like that in many countries. And therefore, I think I feel unhappy about the fact that when you talk about relationships, the final analysis points out to certain points and is emphasized in certain points, which, in my opinion, does not represent the real feeling. But then, I think writers are free, certainly the press is free, to say and do whatever they want. And, of course, that's also their responsibility. How much should I have? 5 minutes more?
No, yeah, 5 or 10.
All right. There are many issues that can be quoted and discussed to show the strains and bad relationship and confrontations and criticism between the United States and the Third World. I would like to close off, select rather personally, I think, two issues. And I will not go into the in-depth, in all of that, because many of these issues, and I mean the South African issues, and the disarmament rapprochement now between United States and Russia after the meeting of President Reagan and Gorbachev. Because it seems to me many of these issues are very complex. But if you scratch the skin, you can go to some of the basics which have never been changed. And the two issues I choose because, in my opinion, and certainly being at this institute, the first one in South Africa shows how, while America has already done quite a bit and has changed its policies, I think America can still do more and, in fact, act decisively to solve this problem. And the other one, I think, the matter of disarmament, I think that President Reagan, and I'm not an admirer of his style and policies, and not quite often at least, I think for whatever reason he did it, he did a great service to the world by entering into these direct negotiations and coming up finally with the INF agreement. Because my hope is that in the end, when the next summit of the non-aligned movement will be held, and it's very soon, hopefully, in Belgrade in September this year. Although, as you probably know, the country seems to be in great danger of falling apart now. So people don't know whether the summit will be held. But I hope that for the first time, and I'm jumping actually to my conclusion, I hope that for the first time, the United States will be commended, with the Soviet Union probably, commended for something for which the Third World will be very, very grateful. Because from the very first summit in Belgrade, and every summit after that, they have called on the United States and the Soviet Union as the superpowers who are only capable of changing the arms race in this world. Well, they have never called on NATO. They have never called on the Western world. They have never called on the Warsaw Pact. They have always said, you too. You can do it. If you will do it, it can be done. And I think it's perhaps a show of the astuteness, after all, of the leaders of the Third World, that in their assessment of this international situation, they have seen that if you go to the heart of the matter, it's a direct relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union. And if their leaders are willing to meet, something is possible. And it's always been said, you are too unsettled. You don't know if the world is more complex than that. It cannot be done. But as so often in this last few months, I think, all the impossible seem to happen. And we don't know why, but it seemed to happen. But I'm not already in this last one. Let me say something about South Africa. I've already said something about the anti-colonial feeling and anti-racial feeling. And I think nobody wants blood to flow, certainly flow abundantly, as it is threatened. You, as you well know, Kenneth Kaunda, the president of Zambia, has at one time said, maybe it's a rather flowery of rhetoric way of thinking, If no problem is being found, and soon in South Africa, there will be a bloodbath that will make the French Revolution look like a Sunday school picnic. I think it's probably exaggerating, but blood is going to flow, I'm sure, if nothing has been happened. And I don't think it's necessary. Neither white blood nor the black blood, if you can say it like that, because blood being red anytime. But I still don't think there's need for that. And I said to some of my students, African students, I am on your side, but there's one thing that you should at least give me the assurance, that the white people should have a chance to stay and participate in a different form in your society. Because there's no sense of trying to change the situation and come up with a completely different problem. That's to say, what to do with these white people. They have a right to stay there. The only thing is they should stay there in a completely different social and legal and cultural structure. But if they are willing to accept, it must be possible for them to find a life there and contribute, because everybody knows that they can contribute to the betterment of South Africa. So I think thinking along those lines, and knowing that America has a great say in what happens there, that its means of exerting pressure on South Africa is perhaps the greatest instrument that can be exerted to make change, as we have already seen now, then I think, and I hope, that President Bush will indeed think it over again, whether in this sense he would continue the line drawn by President Reagan and perhaps would not follow the line which I think most of the American people have already shown to favor, and that is that the black people should be far more drawn into the government of their own country. And I think if that can be done in the next 4 years, surely President Bush would find for himself a place in the third world which is probably equal to that of what President Reagan has done, has achieved. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This opens up a whole area. Do you want to recognize people in this?
All right, just go ahead. Cool. Sure, there are questions? Comments? Reactions?
Asia, now Zimbabwe, pretty harshly. They don't want it repeated, in particular in South Africa. So how do you deal with that? I know the changes are coming.
Yes. Could you tell me what particular aspect of Rhodesian life do they object so much to or against?
Well, the point they're afraid that they will be overwhelmed, pretty much as Rhodesia was taken completely over.
Yes.
And the white really don't have a full say.
Yes.
From their viewpoint, yes. I don't know.
I was in, as I said, in this conference in Harare, of course, in 86. And I was, in fact, very much overwhelmed by emotions when I saw this Salisbury at one time, now called Harare, because it resembles so very much the town where I come from, was Bandung. Nice, little town, beautiful, and I see, this was in the colonial time, the white people were walking all around. The shops were white shops. The black people are coming up and they don't mix. But I don't think, indeed, that there is a duty to mix. People should have the same rights. They have the right to ignore one another, although you can question whether morally that's right. But I think there is no need to mix. And what I've seen there, and I give Mugabe credit for that, he has started, as you know, the term reconciliation policies. And there is reconciliation. Because the white people are walking around. They have their farms, they have their business, and they contribute, and that is the smartness of Mugabe. He knew the country would fall apart if the white people would leave. Now the question is, what will he do in due time? Suppose the young Zimbabweans would come back from foreign universities and be great and good in business, in other words. Would there be a place for the white people? Well, that has to be seen, I think. There is, and that is the price that you pay for taking, for allowing the majority to take over, that as a minority, you have to step back. I belong to minority. When I was in the colonial time, my minority in Indonesia, the Moluccans, we were Christians, and therefore favor. I pay the price for that now, and I think it's right. One of the reasons of my not going back to Indonesia, because I don't think I have a right to some of the top jobs there. My family never fought the bloody war. We were caught in between. My father was in the army, Dutch army. We were caught in between, and therefore I think we were not really in the liberation movement. But what I've seen, therefore, in Rhodesia, that those people, the whites who control the country, have slaughtered thousands and thousands of white, of black people. But now they walk around without any trouble. And in fact, it's my hope, and it's the other way around from what South Africa said, it's my hope that it's possible to emulate Zimbabwe in South Africa. Because the problem is not solved. It depends now on the two groups, whether they are capable of finding some modus vivendi together. And I'm rather unhappy to see that indeed they live next to one another. They just pass one another, they don't talk to them. But they recognize each other's rights, and I think that's at least the beginning. But again, as I said, I don't think that I would ever favor any policy in South Africa that slaughters the white people. In fact, and that's the strength again of the, if I may just add, the African National Congress has gone on record saying that all white people who wanted to stay can find a place there, and it, their safety is guaranteed. What will happen, of course, we don't know. But it's much better that the future leaders have gone on record saying that, because they are committed to that now and stuck with it. And the country is so rich. If that country starts to develop, it will rival all African countries, I think. Thank you.
Next question.
Is it possible that the severe damage the Japanese did psychologically, financially, administratively to the French Empire, Southeast Asia, the Indonesian Dutch connection, and the British in Malaysia, and of course those European companies were virtually financially bankrupt at the end of the day.
Yes.
But if they had been able to play a more meaningful role, then many of the problems would not exist today, probably in a part of the world. I don't think it'd be heaven. Was it possible an orderly transition could have taken place if the Japanese hadn't done so much damage?
Yes, you were thinking particularly about material and damage.
Administrative.
Yes, I mean, administrative damage. To be frank, I'm not sure. I live in Holland. I go back every year. And I look at my country with some distance, fortunately, that's possible because I'm away. And I'm amazed, in spite of all the wars, what a people can do in 40 years. I was told in the colonial time, and family, some of my friends and family have suffered from that, that certain things we cannot do. For instance, flying. It was not possible. We were too short. We were no good for a plane. We were too short. Another thing. We were in Southeast Asia one of the first countries where the national airlines was flown all by Indonesians. And we belong, as people say, to the best pilots because we have that sensitivity, our fingers. If you walk now Jakarta, which is a huge city, a terrible city, I think. But it is architecturally bad, but it has been achieved by people who at one time were incapable to build a house in 40 years. That talent that is developed, if the opportunity arises, is all over there. You could, of course, make the argument if the transfer had been done in a better way, we would have been there before, probably. But I think the talent was just waiting to develop, and they used every opportunity to use it. And I think if you look at Southeast Asia, nowadays, apparently, Indonesia and Malaysia, which were at one time the problem child, have come up to a level where I saw recently that the World Bank was looking at Indonesia as a model of a developing country that was capable to make up for the loss in oil revenue by starting activities in non-oil commodities to such an extent that it has become the model. Now, I know being a model is quite often getting the kiss of death, because in 10 or 20 years, you're complete. That happened with so many more models. But I'm not afraid of the ability of our people to achieve whatever is possible with the available resources. That I think we can do. But we need, of course, support from outside. And there is where the Japanese have shown that they're willing to come to our aid. Southeast Asian countries would, at this moment, not be able to come where they are if they had not been given the aid that the Japanese have given. And we are somehow a little bit in ambiguous to say we don't like the Japanese, but we like the money. So we don't know. We talk about these little yellow people, which actually, and they are not very nice. They always isolate themselves when they come. They have their own hotels. They have everything. That's fine. They don't have to like us. But as long as they come with the money and we can borrow that, that's fine. So I don't think that the transfer, while it has been bad, and we have suffered from that, in the end has some lasting bad effects on us. In fact, Indonesia and Malaysia are being now called as the next newly industrializing countries that will rival with Korea and Taiwan. I don't think it will come very quickly, but it's a movement, I think.
Good example of what you said is that when, after independence, some of us started to travel in Indonesia, well, we almost breathed a sigh of relief when at the Garuda offices they would say, fully booked. But that has changed, I gather, hasn't it? You go there?
Yes.
I think the thing that bothers me is the big grab bag you have of unaligned, because within that bag you get a wide range of differences, and sometimes you get a lot of oversimplification.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned Indonesia. Indonesia has prospered, as has Malaysia, because they have been having a more level playing field so far as external investment is concerned. Right. It's been welcomed, and the people have been well treated, and the investors have been able to get confidence. Now, after the Union Carbide situation in India, is there going to be a big slowdown in investment in India, because that whole situation is kind of ridiculous?
Yes.
But so you have, when you talk about the attitude of outside capital coming in, this varies because you have so many different governments and so many different points of view. There are plenty of countries in Africa where an investor would have to be out of his mind to invest. Therefore, I think that this third world reference and putting the third world as a separate community, as it were, as against the West, and or particularly the U.S., is really fairly destructive in getting an understanding.
Yes.
Don't you think there's an element of
that?
Well,
that is a point of view. And there are some people, although I think it's a minority, that even say, and there was an article recently by an economics professor in Holland who was just appointed, and in his first speech said, there is no third world. Because the variation is so big that indeed you have to talk about whether there are groups of developing countries being one more developed than others, having different interests, and therefore don't feel any linkage.
And different people.
Right. Yes. Now, there were other people who say the other extreme. There was this man saying that the third world is falling apart. Why? Because it's successful. So many of the third world countries are now coming up as developed countries, and therefore they're falling apart, the same thing. However, how is it then to explain that with all the possibilities of going their own way, they still aspire to cling together and meet and draw policy lines together? One thing, of course, I can answer you. because they know that numbers count. In this international world, where international organizations are so important, where diplomatic meetings are finally decided by majorities, they know numbers count. But besides that, I think, and that is the point that I'll try all the time to show you, to prove, but it's difficult to prove. I think there are elements of feeling, of sensitivity in the concept of third world that appeals to the sensitive people of the third world. And therefore, they are, the non-aligned movement is growing all the time. Every new state wants to join it. Partly because it feels alone, it is nowhere. But secondly, there's a feeling of identification. And that's very important. As you well know, I don't have to tell you that there was great criticism in the third world after this oil crisis and the OPEC countries starting out and forgetting that they were hitting their own brothers. And from the very first moment, there was some negotiation and it never was really solved whether this special fund for the poor people should be set up or not set up and how to develop that. It has never been completely solved. And I think the least developed countries are indeed in trouble. But even the least developed countries are not trying to jump out. So I think it's both. It's a matter of being part of a big group helps, but also you can identify yourself with the general aim of I'm not a socialist state. I'm surely not a rich country that can belong to the West. I belong in the middle. And perhaps this gives me opportunity to say that this being in the middle, certainly for sensitive and rather people thinking in terms of morality, as we said before, being in the middle has the additional connotation of perhaps having the right position. And that counts, I think, in people in the third world. The third world, the third way, the third group has the connotation which I at one time saw, I think I may have it here, I picked it up in '53 and then in America, actually. I'm not sure what it is. This one. Nice that you remind me of that. It's a small picture that was shown. I would like to ask you when it exist. It was picked up in some journal in '53, and it says, the Chinese say are three sides for every question. My side, your side, and the honorable right side. I checked this with one of my top Chinese lawyers in Europe that I know. Perhaps you know him too, I'll mention later. And he said, well, I'm not sure whether it's this way, but at least there is this feeling that's a third side that is worth to be considered all the time. The truth, or who is right, is quite often somewhere in the middle, and that's worth considering. Now, that kind of feeling is part of the concept of the third world, I think. Not being able to join the two, feeling that you cannot stand alone, and then being able to identify you with a group. That makes for the third world, and it's still there. It may fall apart. They have no monopoly on survival forever, I think. But it's still there. And I think it still survives. And this whole thing of claiming the new international economic order, it is going nowhere, as you well know, the whole movement. But if something is going to happen, it can only be achieved by concerted pressure by the whole group. And that they have seen. So seeing their interest in sticking together, they stick together. Although every now and then you see it's like a family. They would just quarrel.
As chairman, I'm going to claim the privilege of throwing a question at my old friend myself. Early in your talk, you mentioned the tendency of revolutionary leaders in the third world to look to the American presidency as a model of executive leadership, emphasizing, perhaps exaggerating, the power of the American president. I wonder to what degree political leaders in various countries of the third world, and obviously they're not all equally sophisticated in this respect, to what degree have they come to understand the limitations as well as the potentialities of the American president? That is to say, the complexities of our political system, The ways in which the president is hamstrung by Congress,
yes,
by the press, by public opinion, and the like. Do they understand the nuances of the American political system enough to take an active, develop an accurate understanding of what our policy is and what it is not, and when rhetoric is to be taken seriously, and what promises can be made and delivered, and which ones cannot, and things of that sort? Or do they exaggerate and oversimplify the power structure in the American political system?
I think perhaps the fair answer is most of them do not, of course. But it differs from person to person, and it differs according to his background. A person like Lee Kuan Yew, for instance, I think he is so smart that he can never claim not to know the American model. He is so smart, he's one of the smartest person. I think he was number one, I think, in some of the English top schools. Although nowadays, of course, he is very much criticized for the rather dictatorial powers that he seems to wield. Whether they are according to his constitution or whether he goes beyond that is a different matter. They must decide for themselves. But he should know. But there are other presidents, and I would not mention the name, only because my president in Indonesia, he was a military man. But he's a very smart man. He can talk better now than I can or others in my institute about what really development means or should mean. But I think he does not know what the American political system actually is or how it operates. But I assume that the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the one we have now, Alatas, which was at one time the chairman of the Group of 77, that he knows, and the advisor knows. But I'm not sure whether they give so much weight to that, because I'm always surprised by some of our leaders. If they look at the American system and you want to copy it in your own style and come up with an executive president and develop and interpret it in your way, that's fine, because it is, as it were, emulating something in your own style. But then they come with this political monstrosity of a president for life. Who ever is so stupid to make himself a president for life? And it happens. And then they have a very short life and they kicked out, and then you wonder why the next one does not take some lessons from that. I don't think any that. I think the younger generation that is coming up will have no excuse. And then many are coming this way, and many are studying the American political system as political scientists or lawyers. But I'm afraid that those who come to power are not always the intellectual ones. They are those who, by way of character and charismatic attitude, know to rise to the top. And they are not always those who are willing to copy the American system. Although I must admit, if you have not been in America, have not studied it, it's perhaps very difficult to see and understand the American system. And therefore, this whole thing, the executive president, that's what it's like.
Is there an inner conflict among third world leaders? I chaired a 12 donor agency review of higher education in Africa and Asia, and we had all the groups, the World Bank and the two Canadian agencies, AID and so on. And we met, right, we had regional teams chaired by nationals in the country concerned, and we went to the regions. We met in either Jakarta or Singapore several times, and in Manila. Speaker after speaker from Asia would say, "It's a pity that we seem to be clashing, because we really are." In one sense, cut from the same cloth. We went to your schools, we read your books, we share your values, and yet we have these differences that divide us. So you have that on the one hand, this common, at least educational and intellectual, even moral tradition. And then you have on the other hand the equidistant idea. And now, even within the Soviet Union, Gorbachev is disclosing that all through the period, if you go back to Bandung and 55, the remnants of Stalinism were still there, yes. And cruelty to anybody who differed with practice, psychiatric hospitals and so on. Is there at least a tension, if not a contradiction, between what people on the right in this country would call moral equivalence, the equating of the two societies, and this preference for our education, our values, our heroes? Sukarno, I sat through a 5-hour commencement address by Sukarno one time.
Yes.
And
you survived.
And survived. but he devoted half of the time, to, as you said, to Jefferson, Washington, yes, Lincoln, yes, yes. But the other half to Lenin, Marx, yes, and the other
indeed.
Side.
Indeed.
And so the equidistant principle came out, whatever. But how can the Third World resolve this conflict within their own minds, yes, about these two things?
Well, I personally always felt that the so-called pursuing equidistance is only in words being put. But if you go deeper and you look at me, we all, and certainly in Indonesia, the way we have been raised would be seen, I think, in socialist world as real little bourgeois people. I have still now, as a lawyer, going through all my studies, if I see a book coming from the Soviet Union, the Socialist International Law, I can't read it. And I think if Mr. Gorbachev is doing a lot about new thinking, he should do something about new talking and new writing, because I can't read it. And I have never been able to have sympathy for that. So I think if you might look in terms of where our sympathies lie, maybe not deliberately, it goes in the Western direction. There's no doubt about it. It's a great advantage, both for us and the Western world, that we seem somehow to have better common ground than the other side. I'm not sure what will happen if they change now and opening up. It might change. But my generation, we have been brought up in the typical lower middle class style. People going to school wanted to get a good job, and then that's it. But we have never looked. I could not discuss with people from, let's say, Vietnam, the socialist tradition and thinking. That's completely. I see the world again about the ruling class and alienation and all these things. I've never been raised like that. I don't even like them, because I have not been raised like. In other words, Sukarno could do it. Partly because Sukarno was very superficial. So he could do it. And other people could do it, as the Indians would be able to say, if you disagree with them, then they would say, you don't understand. Because we in our Indian culture, we have the ability to reconcile two completely irreconcilable things. We can do that. Because that's the culture. And probably they can, but I can't do it.
Japanese do that.
They do that too. You see, but I think if you look at people like me, and there are many like me, we have been raised as little bourgeois people. And we can never came out of that. And it's, we felt much easier, Indonesia left to go, to Holland of all places. The Dutch community, the Indonesian community in Holland is far bigger than it ever was. They don't like to go to Germany. They don't speak German, they speak Dutch. They know the weaknesses and the strengths of the Dutch people. So they like the Dutch people. Some even marry a Dutch girl, so... Yes. I think that is probably a mystery for outside people. But for us, it's not so...
It seems to me the term non-aligned has problems in this country. If this country were a centralized dictatorship, then... The people of the non-aligned countries would be dealing with a small group of people, or one person.
Yes.
But when you're dealing with Congress, it seems to me you're dealing with to some extent, a reflection of public opinion. And in that sense, it seems to me the term non-aligned really comes across as, if you're non-aligned, you're non-friendly, in all likelihood. It's negative. And yet you talked a few minutes ago about this group representing more than the negative objection, the confrontation approach, representing,
yes,
a positive sense of something that they want to create,
yes,
something, a society, a way of How can that be developed in a way, in a positive way, that will exist beyond, I mean, in a sense, there's a built-in self-destruction of this non-alignment. They all become prosperous, then there isn't anything to argue about. Unless there is some a sense of identity and positive creation.
Yes. Probably it could be partly be replied, I could reply it like this. As long as the rivalry, whether it's Cold War or another war, exists, that has always been an obsession of the countries, the developing countries. Maybe now less than in the beginning. Certainly in the Belgrade time, Nehru was an exponent of that thinking. Sukarno also, and others. The whole idea that the world might explode while you're just starting, that was something that they couldn't accept. And the rhetoric, also from the two superpowers, of course, was such that it was hardly subtle. It was about whether we have the first strike or not the first strike capability and being able to destroy. Well, that, of course, would draw us in destruction. And not feeling, not being able to identify yourself completely with either side, it's understandable, perhaps, that they say, I would like nothing to do, I would nothing to do with that. Now, that is the negative aspect. But they soon realized that you cannot just live in this world and pose a negative picture and not have something positive, alternative to show. And then they started to feel that you have to organize. You cannot just use words, you have to organize yourself. And in that sense, I think they have been, if I look at the oldest generation, they have been very, very clever and smart. I would never have thought that they would be able to organize a world to a level where there is now something as a non-aligned movement. In fact, I would say, from my studies at school, and we talked to Ennis about it, if they ever had asked me, when I just finished school and I went to Indonesia back, and they asked me, we're going to set up an organization, new non-aligned organization, without a treaty, we just have the political will to come together. I say, you stupid. How can you do that? My book said, if you start, make clear what you want. Be clear of your objectives. Be clear about the structure, how you move. Be clear about your rights and your obligations. Then if there's a problem, you just look at your constitution. And you are there, you solve the problem. Not them. They went completely the different direction. They said, let's just live together and see whether we can live together and we have common ground. We have the political, at least, to move. Let's see slowly. But they succeeded. ASEAN is now one of the most popular regional organizations in the third world. It's being a model for Africans. They go there and they study whether they can copy it. I would have said it was not possible. It's the wrong thing to go about. So I have become far more humble in my evaluation of these so-called upcoming, inexperienced people. They are far smarter. They have not had the education that they have, but in practice they are so smart. They see the possibilities, and they move, and they try all different options. They are very, very smart. And therefore I have hope that now in this way they play, they have also seen limitations, of course. They know that the third world is not a very powerful in terms of military, economic, but diplomatically they are very smart. And therefore I hope that the smartest on the diplomatic level can be used on both sides in terms of the third world and the United States. And therefore this, I think, disappointed on my side that I don't see the smart people that I know in the law school. I could not touch these smart people in my law school or in the international school in Yale. But I've never seen them coming up in the administration. They are probably in business and in practice, well, and they're doing fine. But what we need, I think also, and perhaps it's very difficult for a big power, because you have to work and deal at the same time with 150 countries who are all critical and all expect an expert on the other side to talk to. And that's probably impossible. And that's the problem that has to be solved, probably.
But I think it must be possible in general, on the general level. And that's I think there was one point where I was thinking of Mr. Jackson. Mr. Jackson was saying that, for instance, small countries in the third world would no longer be able to have the non-aligned summit, because for becoming a host, you must have a big city with good hospitals, good communications, facilities for press and all these things. But I wonder whether in our poor world we should compete with the Western world with the best hospitals for diplomats. Our diplomats should be development diplomats. Diplomats who are moving around in the world at the cheapest level, going in the cheapest hotel. But they don't like me if I say that, because they say you have a good job, and you envy us. But I think if you are from a poor country, there's no need for having all the top facilities, flying first class in the big planes, a young diplomat, because he has going to come. There's no need for that. He's using our tax money's pay, tax money. So he should not do that. And therefore, I think I disagreed with one of the few points with Mr. Jackson. I think it is possible to have a poor man's conference, where diplomats, as I saw in Harare, there were 5 diplomats in 1 car. That's good. Oh, let them walk. Who cares? Let them walk. And as far as facilities are concerned, Harare didn't have enough cars. He could borrow cars from Zambia. Zambia has borrowed cars. And I think that is the thing that can be done. And these little nuances, talking about nuances, that's where I disagree a little bit with Jackson all the time. I think there are more possibilities that can be shown. But it's us ourselves that should be doing that.
Well, I'm sure we've heard things that we'll want to remember for some time to come. This business of penetrating another person's consciousness and fears, I think, was once summed up by our mutual friend Sojat Moko. He said, the problems of nations are a little bit like the problems of spouses. He said, I'm now 60, and I have yet to meet a couple who will in total candor say, we understand the deepest fears, anxieties, hopes, aspirations of our spouse, even after 30, 40 years of marriage. And if that's true in that most intimate of communities, how much more true is it among nations? So I think you've given us something that we'll want to ponder and think about for a long time to come. Thank you.
Thank you.